Greetings. Welcome to Meaty Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, coming to you today. Our guest today is going to be someone you've heard often on this program. John Nichols will be joining us, this time not to raise money for WIL, but rather to talk about his brand new book, The S Word, A Short History of an American Tradition Socialism. It's going to be a great show, but before we go to our guest, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
A good community radio station can give voice to the people and can serve as a vehicle for social justice organizing, political engagement, and cultural understanding. But it's tough to get a license for a radio station. The Federal Communications Commission allows very few opportunities to apply for licenses, and the process is complicated. The last time the FCC allowed applications to be filed for full-power community radio stations was in 2007, and the application window lasted only a week. Common Frequency was formed in 2006 to help shepherd nonprofit groups through the technical and bureaucratic application process. The FCC awarded hundreds of permits to construct radio stations throughout the country. While some of those groups completed the process and are on the air, others are struggling to get up and running.
When you're given a construction permit by the FCC, you have 36 months to build your FM station or you lose your license. There are about 30 of these groups who are facing an expiration date in 2011 and, you know, an additional 75 or so following 2012 and 2013.
Gavin Dahl is an AmeriCorps Vista volunteer working with Common Frequency for a year. He says that the last 100 stations face major obstacles beyond their control. The ravages of a down economy is a major factor, but not the only one. This year, Congress killed funding for the program that subsidized public service TV and radio equipment.
And these are Department of Commerce funds that were to the tune of $19 million this year for groups trying to put together $75,000 to build the equipment they need for a studio and a transmitter site. Having the opportunity to have half or 75% of their funds met in a grant program from Commerce has led to some great success stories.
KRBX in Boise, Idaho, and WGXC in Hudson, New York are two of those success stories. They've recently gone on the air thanks to funds from the KILD program that are now denied to other licensees. Common Frequency and other groups are working to convince the FCC and Congress to give an extension to the groups who are coming up against their expiration dates. Dahl says he's hopeful the FCC will respond in order to help bring some diversity to media ownership of the airwaves. Some of these stations will be the only radio station in their area, and many of the stations are in remote areas of Native American lands.
That's a really important thing. We are talking about Native groups and people with points of view that are not represented in commercial media or the sort of established public media.
For more information, go to commonfrequency.org.
A panel at the National Conference for Media Reform in Boston in early April delved into the missteps and failures the media makes when it comes to reporting on transgender and gender nonconforming people. The panelists said that news outlets often outright ignore transgender issues, use inaccurate gender pronouns, or sensationalize, sexualize, and scandalize transgender people in stories. The result? A culture that widely misunderstands the transgender community, which can lead to hostility, discrimination, and violence against transgender individuals. Laura Carizzi is the manager of public education for the organization Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders in New England. She spoke on the panel about how journalists could improve the reporting on transgender issues.
So I think that the media has a very important responsibility when you're reporting on these issues, cover them fairly and accurately. And that's just all about getting some knowledge.
During the panel, Carrizzi offered several tips to reporters.
The first is know your terminology. The trans community is very diverse. For instance, cross-dresser is a very specific term and shouldn't be used to describe someone who has transitioned to live full-time as the other sex or intends to.
Carrizzi says reporters should approach police reports critically. She said police often misuse terminology in the reports that sets the stage for misleading stories.
And that's how you see headlines like male victim wearing a wig and a dress. And sometimes that's in the police report. I think things like that are red flags.
She also suggested checking gender emphasis. She told reporters to ask, why are you including a subject's gender identity in your story?
And in 2009, a young guy who was texting while he was doing his job driving a TE caused a serious accident. And his transgender status was reported on that. But did it relate to what he did? It's a question that you really need to ask. How does someone's trans identity matter in a story?
The audio archive of the entire panel discussion and the rest of Carrizzi's guidelines for reporters can be found at freepress.net/conference.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, and WILL AM 580. Our guest today is John Nichols, who's joining me here in our mobile studio. We're recording this program just 3 or 4 days before going on air, so please don't call in today. Let John and me do the talking. John Nichols, I don't think, needs an introduction to anyone who's ever listened to Media Matters. He's been our most popular and most familiar guest. I think John Nichols has been on the show at least 15 times, at least, if not 20 times, in the past 9 years since we first went on air, almost 9 years ago exactly. And he's usually here. In fact, he's always here during our pledge drives 2 or 3 times a year. And we also get him on when he has a new book out to talk about, which he does right now. His new book out is The S Word, A Short History of an American Tradition, Socialism, just published by Verso, literally just came out within the last 2 weeks. We're going to be talking about it for the full hour. But again, I regret to say, because we're recording it, don't try to call and sit back, relax. Let John Nichols and me do all the yakking today. Welcome to Media Matters, John Nichols.
It's great to be with you, Bob.
Well, obviously, I sort of like your work. You sort of probably knew that.
Yeah, we've been familiar.
Yeah, and but I, as you can see looking over here, this book is already dog-eared. Yeah. I've enjoyed it, reading it so much, and I have a strong feeling that virtually everyone who listens to the show regularly will have the same response when they do read it. And it's funny. I'll tell a story before we get to this. John and I were, a year ago at this time, we're traveling the country talking about our book, The Death and Life of American Journalism. And we'd be talking a lot. He'd always come up with these really interesting stories about Abraham Lincoln and stuff. I mean, well, John's doing some interesting stuff on the side, but he didn't tell me what it was. Then suddenly I go on Amazon one day, and I see an advertisement for a book called The S Word by John Nichols. And so that's what John's been up to the last couple of months, and it all came out. And here the book is. And, well, why did you want to write the book, John?
Yeah. Well, I wanted to write the book, I think, for the same reason that we enjoyed those conversations about American history. I have always loved the history of this country and been fascinated by it. And I've had a sense in the last, maybe, well, it's actually the better part of the last 20 years, but especially in the last few years, that a huge part of our history has been obscured, arguably even stolen from us. And we live in an age now where it's suggested that our history sort of began when a bunch of free market capitalists got together, anticipating Milton Friedman, and set up a state that Friedman would love. And then a couple of scary guys like Franklin Roosevelt came along. But basically, we've kind of kept to that principle. And the emblematic president of our time and of any time would have been Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. And the weird thing is that notion, so out of sync with the American story and so out of sync with our history, is now accepted not merely by Reaganite Republicans, but by a lot of Democrats and a lot of pundits. And so we have this narrative developing in the United States that socialism, social democratic ideas, radical ideas are somehow foreign imports, that they have very little to do with this country, and that to the extent that they've ever existed here or that they might exist here, they sort of had to be snuck in or arrived via some sort of parcel package from the Soviet Union. When in reality, look, the fact is Tom Paine imagined A Social Democracy, in his final great pamphlet, Agrarian Justice. Horace Greeley, the editor of the New York Tribune, employed Karl Marx as his European correspondent. Abraham Lincoln read Marx on a regular basis and corresponded through intermediaries, Charles Francis Adams, with Marx. And, you know, as we moved into the late 19th and early 20th century, socialists and social democrats were elected to Congress, to mayoralties, to state legislatures, and their ideas became, you know, very, very deeply rooted in most of what we think of as the shaping of modern America.
So in that sense, John Nichols, Glenn Beck and Fox News and the people who go on the warpath about America having a sort of foreign socialist influences we have to get rid of, in a way, the foreign part's wrong, but the socialist influence part's right.
Well, they are right. Yeah, exactly. In fact, socialist and social democratic ideas have been alive in this country from before the founding. There's simply no question. And frankly, I know the Tea Party movement would like to imagine that it was an anti-government, you know, kind of assault on big government, sort of an imagining that someday Barack Obama would come with a health care plan. And so they threw tea into the Boston Harbor. But the Tea Party movement, the original one in 1773, was an anti-corporate movement. It was about the confluence of power between government and business, government and corporate entities. And it's bizarre when you look back at the speeches of many of the founders, you find a great deal of reflection on the danger of this, on the threat.
Yeah, well, for one thing, I mean, and this isn't about socialism, but it's about capitalism. Capitalism, as Americans understand it today, and as the Tea Party understands it, and as everyone experiences it, is a series of very large corporations that are unimaginably huge, that employ gazillions of people and dominate their markets and are international operations. And most people work for them or they're related to someone who works for them. The economy is run by them. The free market or private enterprise economy of the United States prior to the last third of the 19th century, well, it might have had private property. It was nothing like the current notion of what capitalism is. Mm-hmm. I mean,
You're exactly right. And this is the fascinating thing. If you go through the history in this country of socialist and social democratic movements, what you find is that they existed very comfortably with the idea of the small farm or the small shopkeeper. There's no, you know, kind of like overarching big government concept to American socialism, American social democracy. In fact, what any of the leaders of the Socialist Party in its years of greatest strength from 1900 into the 1930s, when it regularly received the better part of a million votes in election after election, when it coalesced with Robert M. La Follette in 1924 for the most successful left-wing presidential candidacy in the country's history, winning a better part of 13% of the vote and electoral votes and doing quite well.
Carrying Wisconsin.
Carrying the state of Wisconsin.
And the city of Cleveland.
And the city of Cleveland. And also carrying, you know, a lot of ethnic and immigrant neighborhoods across the country, as well as coming number two in the better part of a dozen western states. And even later in that period, when you had socialist mayors of big cities into the 1950s and early 1960s, again and again, when you go back in the history, you find that the kind of core people in those movements were small shopkeepers. And in the rural areas, small farmers. And these are folks who didn't see the idea of a social democratic government, a social democratic state.
They're socialists. I mean,
yeah.
Even.
But they didn't see it as a threat to their lives. In fact, they saw it as something that empowered them because they recognized, I think perhaps better than we do today, there was much more clarity, that the real struggle was whether their lives would be dominated by distant multinational and national corporations or whether they'd have some sort of small-d democratic control over their circumstance. And so it's a fascinating thing to note. There's a great example from 1948 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, when Frank Zeidler was running for mayor. Mm-hmm. And his opponent, who was a liberal Democrat, said, well, you can't elect Zeidler. He's a socialist. If you elect him, he will impose socialism on this city and take over the neighborhood grocery store. And you know, Zeidler had a pretty good counter to that. He said, well, I've just been endorsed by the Association of Neighborhood Grocery Stores. And in fact, he was, because they recognized he was an opponent of the big chains.
Yeah.
And in fact, was defending him.
Our guest today, John Nichols, author of the brand new book, The S Word, A Short History of an American Tradition Socialism, just published by Verso, just out. We recorded this show 4 days before going on air, so please sit back, relax, let us do the talking today. John Nichols, the probably the leading red baiter of the last couple of years, though by no means the only one, has been Glenn Beck, mm-hmm. who has mm-hmm. made a point of singling out his political enemies, and almost without exception, from Barack Obama to yours truly, calling them Marxist, revolutionary, socialist, whatever term he wants. And, you know, this is sort of a new wave of red baiting that had really been in remission in a lot of ways for a long time in this country. But what's most striking about the Beck attack and the Fox News attack in general and the broader sort of anti-red baiting hysteria has been that what Beck has done that's striking is he's wrapped himself up specifically in two American historical figures, one Tom Paine mm-hmm. and the other Martin Luther King. And so these are sort of the real America. This is my exemplars. Yet as I read your book, they might be two of the four or five most privileged people in your discussion of the socialist tradition in America are precisely the people Beck embraces. I'm confused.
I don't think Beck is confused. I don't think that Mr. Beck has read quite as thoroughly as one might expect. There's a wonderful scene. You know,
the listeners who might not be familiar with our history that great. Everyone's familiar with Martin Luther King, obviously. But Tom Paine, I think, is a name that might, you know, who was Tom Paine? Mm-hmm. What is his importance? And why does he play such a central role, not only in Beck's world, but in your book?
Well, Paine was the essential founder, and I hold to that view very, very strongly. I know that many people see Washington as the essential man, and he was in a lot of ways. He was certainly an able general. But the intriguing thing was that when Washington got in a lot of trouble in 1777, when the war for independence from British colonialism was going rather badly, Washington had to turn to someone to kind of see him through that moment. And, you know, the interesting thing was that the person he turned to was not another general. It wasn't a military strategist. It was Tom Paine. Mm-hmm. And there was reason for that. Paine had written the essential pamphlet that called the United States into being, Common Sense.
Essential, and virtually every adult who was literate in this country read it.
400,000 copies were printed in a country of 4 million people. And what's significant about that is that, of course, a substantial portion of those 4 million were slaves. Mm-hmm. And so assuming that those who had the ability to buy a pamphlet, you're really getting into a substantial, just about every household had one. They had a Bible and they had a copy of Common Sense.
And if you read Common Sense, not to interrupt you, because it's just worth listeners knowing that this is sort of once you've read this book, you're ready to go out and make a revolution.
It's a call to arms. Now, and the incredible thing about Paine was, and people, I think that this happens to so many of our leaders. Certainly it's happened to King, you know, where you kind of sanitize him.
Yeah.
And the assumption is, well, Paine wrote Common Sense, and that said we should revolt against the king, and that's really cool, and now we're done with the guy.
And set up free markets and let business run everything.
Well, what's fascinating about Paine is that before he came to the United States, he had been, of all things, a union organizer. He had tried to organize a union of excise agents, mm-hmm. People, government employees. He tried
workers.
He tried to unionize public workers in King George III's England. Yeah. That did not go over well. So he was dumped on a ship and ended up in Philadelphia. Within a year of getting to the United States, he wrote this book, Common Sense. He was kind of mad at the king. And it spread like wildfire. And it's best understood in a contemporary American context. Mm-hmm. And that is that when Paine wrote it, he sort of forwarded an email. Think of it that way. He wrote the pamphlet, and they printed on the back of it, if you like this pamphlet, feel free to reprint it. I've got no copyright demands on it. I'm not trying to hold on to it. Just spread the word. Mm-hmm. And so it really went through everything. And he became this essential thinker of the revolution.
Yeah.
Now, once you're in the revolution, they're in trouble. So he starts writing these, what are called the crisis papers, and they are really in many ways his most poetic works, but also mm-hmm. also very revolutionary. They basically said, you know, these are the times that try men's souls, and talked about, you know, sunshine patriots versus winter soldiers, those who would fight in the toughest of times. That was what was read at Valley Forge, and it was critical to inspiring.
Yeah, famously.
Yeah. I mean. But then, you know, then, of course, now we've got to forget about Paine, right? And certainly that's where Glenn Beck lost sight of the guy. In fact, famously, when Glenn Beck said he was going to write a book about Tom Paine, mm-hmm. he said on air, you know, I decided I was going to write a new version of Tom Paine's Common Sense. So I said to one of my staffers, go out and buy me a copy of Common Sense. You know, say, I got to read that book. You know, and it's a. And,
I doubt he has yet.
Well, you know, he may have, but the bottom line is if you're going to write.
You read his version.
Yeah, if you're going to update. Yeah, I did read his version, and it was a fascinating experience because, as one reviewer said, there's not much Tom Paine in it. There's a lot of Glenn Beck. Yeah. But what was interesting was when you're going to write about somebody's, you know, statement, their role, their definitional role in American society, you might want to read kind of their whole canon. You might want to read all.
Yeah.
It's not that hard with Paine. He didn't, you know, it's not like massive books. Yeah. He wrote pamphlets. And if you did, what you would find is that, you know, well, not long into the American experiment, he began to say very bluntly, look, you begin by having a revolution, but then you have to form a civil society. You have to have a government. You have to figure out how you're going to do things. And in a series of books of Vindication of the Rights of Man and others, he began to outline a vision of a social democracy, mm-hmm. A social welfare state. And his last great pamphlet, Agrarian Justice, was a pure outline of a social welfare
state. That's around 1800, early
1800? Late 1700s. And it was a remarkable book because he not only...
Which you quote at length, I should say, in the essay.
Yeah, because it's lost to history.
Yeah, it's not your interpretation. There's a lot of extraordinary stuff in there.
No, I mean, this is he unquestionably imagined Social Security. And I'm not the one saying that. The Social Security Administration, if you go to their website, says this started with Tom Paine. Right?
You know, I'll tell you, John, when I read that section from Paine in your book, it looked, and this is going to sound shocking, it looked a lot like sort of the list of demands at the end of the Communist Manifesto that Marx and Engels make, which is basically for social security and transportation and infrastructure.
Housing, yeah, education.
It's not for taking over heavy industry and having the government run everything.
Although Paine went a little further. Paine did say that every individual kind of starting out in life should be given a whole bunch of money by the government.
Yeah.
Just kind of throw money at them. Yes. And if they're poor, throw more at them.
Beck missed that part.
And then Paine said, well, where would you get that money? And he said, well, that's easy. People who have too much property. And he was very, very blunt about it. And he costed it out.
We've talked about this, but I mean, I think listeners should know this, that was a radical idea, but not that radical. Benjamin Franklin was a big believer that there was a limit to how much property a person should have, that after a certain point where you couldn't consume it or couldn't manage it, that should be turned over to the state or sold off. You should not be allowed to keep it. There's a limit to how much wealth an individual should have.
And there's traditions of this that go back, you know, deeply rooted into both the British and the British colonial experience, the levelers, the diggers, so many folks who had talked about this. So these are not new ideas. They weren't even particularly new with Paine.
So Paine, in many respects, to interject here, I mean, this is the guy who's a central figure in defining the American Revolution for the people who fought to make it happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, without him, it's hard to imagine the revolution actually being successful.
Well, Jefferson and others said as much. They said he was so critical to it. And Paine believed he loved America. He wanted America to work. And so he had this vision of how to do it. Now, what's fascinating was that Paine was kind of like shoved out of the firmament, if you will, out of the upper reaches of government. Jefferson maintained pretty good relations with him, but the rest of folks got mad at him because he kept calling him to account. He was a rabble rouser, and so he died pretty much forgotten. But the weird thing is that, and this is one of the most fascinating part of doing the book for me, was to find that there was sort of not an underground movement, but a global movement of people who referred to themselves as Paineites.
Mm-hmm.
And in the early 19th century, to be a Paineite was to identify yourself as a pretty radical player, somebody who, you know, liked the American Revolution, liked the French Revolution, but also took an economic vision of that. And there's one of the great Paineites was a woman named Fanny Wright. She was raised by a Paineite dad in Scotland.
Here's an alert. She plays a large role in your book.
She's all over the book.
This is in the book.
Yeah, it's all in the book. But Fanny Wright was this young Scottish woman, very vibrant. And she wrote to the great revolutionaries of her time saying, you know, I want to hang out with you. And of course...
this is in the first half of the 19th century.
Early years of the 19th century. And she was like, you know, 1920 when she did this. A very lovely young woman. And of course, Lafayette in France, who was in his 70s, never turned down an invitation from a young woman. And so he said, well, I'm going to America on my tour of the 50th anniversary of the Revolution, why don't you come with? And Fanny Wright accompanied him as a Paineite, as a passionate Paineite. Now, of course, Lafayette said he slept every night with Paine's Rights of Man under his pillow, or Age of Reason as well. And so, I mean, so these Paineites are roaming around. They go up and see Jefferson, And
Jefferson at this point is, what, 70, 80? Pushing 80.
Yeah, he's very close to death. I mean, these are his last months. And it's this remarkable moment because if you read Jefferson's last statement, it's this very radical statement, very economically based. The great mass of people aren't meant to be ridden, booted, and spurred. You know, they have somebody on their back, somebody wealthy on their back. They're meant to rule themselves. And this was, I think there's very little doubt that this was Fanny Wright's kind of renewing in Jefferson some Paineite stuff. Mm-hmm. But this kept on going. And I don't want to play it out too much because we could go on forever just about Paine. But I will say that a young man in Illinois, young shopkeeper, was a passionate Paineite. In fact, what some people referred to as a red Paineite. And this meant, you know, somebody who took Paine very seriously as an economic thinker. And his name was Abraham Lincoln. And Lincoln was a big reader of Paine. But also one other figure who's close to Lincoln, Walt Whitman, was a passionate Paineite. And when Walt Whitman was a young man in New York, he would walk the streets of neighborhoods where Paine had lived and, you know, try to look up the addresses where he lived, try to find people who might have known him. He was so passionate about this. And Walt Whitman, in his last years of his life, revealed that he was also a passionate follower of Fanny Wright. In fact, one of his last statements was a long soliloquy about how influenced he was by Fanny Wright. Now, the place we cap this all is that Fanny Wright identified passionately through most of her life as a socialist. Mm-hmm. And as, you know, a pre-socialist and then a clear and absolute socialist. And I think that we have to deny an awful lot of history if we take her out of it.
You know, I hate that this is going to sound, I don't mean to come across as pedantic for our listeners, but we have some listeners, I forgot to say, probably not really familiar with who Walt Whitman
is. No, I can't. I think our listeners would know Walt Whitman. Well, Walt Whitman was a great poet of America.
But I mean the greatness of Walt Whitman. I mean, in terms of in the 19th century, he was the dominant American.
In many ways, the definitional poet. American poet. Yeah, yeah. And his.
So we're not talking about those obscure guys you dragged out of some saloon in Laramie, Wyoming, say, hey, this guy has red marks or something.
No. And this is the incredible thing. Whitman, it's one of my favorite things of the book is I read a lot of the last books and articles of the people who were around Whitman. He lived in a working class neighborhood, even though he could have, you know, kind of lived in the best of circumstances. And there was an article in a British publication by a gentleman named Edward Carpenter, who was one of the great British socialists. And he wrote an essay in the 1890s on Whitman as a socialist. And it was brought to Whitman's attention by one of the people who was sort of an attendant, a friend of his. And Whitman said, I read this article and in truth, I'm a good deal more of a socialist than I thought. Mm-hmm. And he ruminated on it. And it was in that discussion that he brought up Fanny Wright. Mm-hmm. And again, these are not unavailable insights. They do exist.
And
but you have to put these pieces together.
What did socialism mean to Walt Whitman when he would use the term, or Fanny Wright, in terms of their society in the 19th century in the United States? What would a socialist politics or economics be? And how does that translate to 2011 United States?
Well, it doesn't end up with the Soviet Union. Now, let's be clear. Socialism in those days was very much associated with freedom. That was the concept that most people were viewed as, most people lived their lives either as slaves or as in a slightly better circumstance than a slave, but not dramatically so. People who were indentured servants, people who had immense amounts of debt and very little freedom to go and shape their lives, to actually realize what we still think of as an American dream. Maybe a little bit of land, a shop, something like that. And the social democrats and socialists, and I use these terms, you know, somewhat interchangeably, but there are distinctions of the 19th century. They argued for using the power of government to give the poor more of the wealth of the land. It wasn't some sort of police state. In fact, quite the opposite. I think there was a lot of what Noam Chomsky might refer to as libertarian socialism, this notion that they didn't like government all that much either, but they did want to use government to free up the land. And so one of the founders of the Republican Party, a guy named Beauvais, was, before he got involved in the founding of the Republican Party, was an active campaigner for a movement, a fascinating movement in the 1840s called the Vote Yourself a Farm Movement. Mm-hmm. And it was a movement aimed at urban poor folks. And it said, vote for these free soil and radical parties. And if we get power, we are going to take lands that are public lands and also lands that are owned by, you know, like kind of distant landlords. And break them up, give them to the people so that folks who live in urban slums can go out and have a farm or, you know, at least move around a village, you know, kind of move out. And that radical concept, the free soil movement, which, again, lost to history. We think, I don't know, I suppose people, you know, they read that in a history book and they say free soil, free men, and they think somehow it's related to slavery.
Yeah.
It was, in fact, it was the Northern struggle against consolidated power.
What was the attitude of these, and I don't want to go too much into this, but just for the sake of listeners to clarify, what was the attitude of these socialists or social democrats, the Walt Whitmans and Fannie Wrights, toward big business as opposed to—
They were horrified by it.
Okay. That seems to be the key.
Yeah, they were terrified by the notion that America would become a plutocracy like the European states against which a revolution was fought. Again, this is that pain tradition coming through. Mm. And it was that if too much power was consolidated in the hands of too few, then we would develop a feudal or monarchical system, even if we had the facade of democracy in a republic.
Now,
and
Glenn Beck's
Lincoln
world,
talked a lot about that.
Well, we're going to get that in a second, but I'm going to hold off on that. That's
okay.
Too important. But, I mean, Glenn Beck will talk about that, but he means basically some government bureaucrat coming in, that the power is always governmental, whereas the socialists, the power was usually private interests, wealth, who then owned the government.
Right. And they saw the government as something that, you know, you competed for. It didn't just exist there as an entity unto itself. It was, you know, you had a left and a right. People tried to get control of it, and they tried to get control for a reason, either to benefit the few or to benefit the many. And one key thing is that socialism throughout this period, the 19th century into the 20th century, was passionate about extending the franchise. One of its biggest advocacies was to bring more people into the political process.
Everyone should vote.
Everyone should vote. And that's the scary thing.
Actually, this is an aside. It's a key theme that runs throughout your book. I mean, the socialist tradition in America has been at the front ranks of every single movement of poor people, women,
African-Americans, Latinos.
You can't look at any of these movements without seeing socialists at the very big front of
them. Very central to it. In fact, you know, I mean, we could go on and on about it, but the one thing to always remember is that the 1963 March on Washington for jobs and freedom. Everybody thinks it was the March on Washington for civil rights. And certainly civil rights was the underpinning, but it was the March for Jobs and Freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Was organized by A. Philip Randolph, with the able assistance of Baird Rustin, both of whom were socialists.
I mean, out socialists.
Not out. I mean, they were A. Philip Randolph bluntly said.
Yeah, they're self-described members, socialists.
There's an important little storyline here, too, because that was known. That was no secret. There was no secret.
That's what
thing.
I meant. It was public knowledge.
And yet, when the march finished in 1963, President John Kennedy invited Randolph and Rustin to the White House for sandwiches. And more importantly, when Randolph, I start one of the chapters on Randolph, a chapter in the book on Randolph. When Randolph turned 70, they had a party for him at Carnegie Hall in New York. It was where he announced what would become the March on Washington movement. And in attendance at that event was Eleanor Roosevelt, the former First Lady of the United States, sitting very near Hubert Humphrey, the future Vice President of the United States, and Republican Senator Jacob Javits of New York. And this was at an event, also Norman Thomas, the frequent socialist candidate for president. This is at an event where a guy who was a leading American socialist was being feted by former First Lady, future Vice President, and President Dwight Eisenhower sent a telegram saying, I'm so sorry I can't be there with you to honor you and all of your great contributions. And so where we're at today, this idea that you know, some sort of association with socialism, you know, makes you evil or scary or awful, that simply wasn't the way that Dwight Eisenhower or Eleanor Roosevelt thought about it.
Our guest today on Media Matters is John Nichols, whose voice you've heard many times in this show. We're talking about his brand new book, The S Word, A Short History of an American Tradition, Socialism, just published by Verso. This show is pre-recorded by 4 days, I think it is, so don't call in. Let John and me, your host, Bob McChesney, do all the talking. This book has got so much in it. We've just touched on the very little bit of the outside of the surface of it. And there are a couple of people I want to get back to because you have long discussions in this book that are fascinating. As you know, probably my favorite one. You've already alluded to it a couple of times, and I've had to calm you down so we can go to it properly. Is Abraham Lincoln and the formation of the Republican Party something that you know that we both have a strong interest in, independent of socialism? I don't think anyone will ever read this book, will ever think again about either Lincoln or the Republican Party the same. It's really nothing short of breathtaking. And so having given you that introduction, let's just explain what you know, what the reality of the Republican Party was up in the 1850s at its formation, who influenced it, and then specifically Lincoln and the socialist influence upon him.
Sure. I mean, there's simply no question to this. And I think the way to go at it, there's so many ways to come in on it. And that's reassuring in a sense, because what we realize is that there's simply no question that the Republican Party was founded by socialists. Not all socialists. There were other folks coming from different traditions. But understand that at the first Republican convention and the first Republican conventions and certainly those events where Lincoln really rose to power, good friends, close allies, correspondents of Karl Marx were delegates and active players in it. In fact, the fascinating thing is that after the 1848 revolution and in revolutions in Europe, one of Marx's closest allies, a military guy named Wiedemeyer, left Germany because he couldn't stay. He had actually turned military units to support the revolution. Mm-hmm. He remained very close to Marx, a close correspondent. And he came to the United States and he started what were called communist clubs. I mean, and they were called communist clubs. And they, you know, they had them in cities all across the country. Wiedemeyer was their kind of like, you know, main organizer and advocate. And then he said, well, you know, we're a little peripheral here. We need to get kind of more into the action. So he merged them into what became the Republican Party. And there, this is not some mystery. Lincoln appointed Wiedemeyer a general. And in fact, Wiedemeyer was the commander of St. Louis, that very contentious city during the Civil War. But he wasn't alone. There were all sorts of people coming from all sorts of different backgrounds. And the best way to understand America in the 1840s and 1850s was that it was a time of incredible intellectual and ideological ferment. Mm-hmm. And at the center of it was Horace Greeley. He was the editor of the New York Tribune. He had been very close to a lot of radical movements in the 1820s and 1830s, had founded the Tribune as basically a daily newspaper and a nationally circulated weekly newspaper that advocated for radical ideas. And that includes free soil and also communal living. Big supporter of Fourier and the French socialist ideas of creating, you know, communal structures and lots of other things. Everything from vegetarianism to feminism. It was a very left-wing publication, the New York Tribune. And it was also the publication out of which the Republican Party essentially blossomed. And Lincoln was a passionate reader of the New York Tribune.
The Tribune's a national paper.
Yeah, it went everywhere. It went through the mails. Yeah, and we've talked a lot about the mails.
Right.
And it was an abolitionist paper. It
became the Republican paper of the 1850s.
It certainly did. In fact, its editor, one of its editors, Charles Dana, ended up as one of Lincoln's chief aides in the White House. And Dana was also, intriguingly enough, the guy who hired Karl Marx to be the European correspondent for the Tribune. Marx and Engels wrote hundreds of articles for
seven volumes of Marx's collected works, more than any other area.
He wrote more. His articles for the New York Tribune form a larger portion of his canon than any of his books. And so he contributed regularly to the New York Tribune. And what's fascinating was that Lincoln served with Greeley in Congress for one term. But they're both of them. Their only time that they were in Congress was this one in the House in this one period. They were quite close and they remained regular correspondents. Lincoln was a passionate reader of the Tribune. The notion that he didn't get to the parts that Marx read as comic, of course he did. And we have a wonderful thing in the book where take an article that Marx and Engels wrote about the revolutionary movements in Hungary. And then shortly after that appeared in the Tribune, the national edition of the Tribune, Lincoln was the lead organizer of a solidarity meeting in Springfield, Illinois, with the Hungarian revolutionaries. I mean, mm-hmm. He was very into this stuff. And the fact is, if you look at his speeches, you see it. You see it again and again.
This is really, I think, you know, just the fact that he knows these guys and hangs out with them. You know, Obama apparently knew Bill Ayer. So
yeah, no, and without a doubt. And I want to make it clear that Lincoln was not, you know, I mean, I'm not saying here Lincoln was some sort of pure socialist
No, this is what I want to get to. What makes it interesting is when you actually look at Lincoln's actual speeches and even policies, which you do in the book. Particularly his attitude towards labor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
and you go into some books. I don't want to steal your thunder, John Nichols.
Well, it's just very simple. I mean, it comes down to a single line. He says labor is superior to capital. You know, and he would say that again and again and again.
And not just like to meetings, to labor groups to get votes.
In his first State of the Union address.
Tell that story.
It's an incredible story.
Yeah, really.
I mean, it was wonderful to write because I think Lincoln remains our most fascinating president in so many ways. And many people focus on Lincoln's inaugural address from 1861, and that was a very important speech. But remember, the inaugural address was written before all hell had broken loose. Mm-hmm. This first State of the Union address given later in the year was really the point at which he was, and it wasn't really, I want to be clear, it's not quite a classic State of the Union address in the way that we think of it now. It was more of an address to Congress. And if you can imagine this, this is late in 1861, Lincoln gets up and he says, you know, it's gotten kind of rough over the last few months. You know, the southern states have seceded. The Supreme Court and our federal judiciary is missing much of its membership because they went with the South. As I speak to you, the members of Congress, many of your seats are empty because, you know, many members of the Senate and House have fled to be part of a rebel government, which is now attacking us. And we have had horrible battles. People are dead. And, you know, everything's, you know, this pretty insane situation we got
here. The greatest crisis in the country's history.
In the country's history. And we're heading into something much worse than where we're at right now. And then Lincoln says, but I would be remiss if I didn't interrupt my remarks here to speak for a bit about the relationship between labor and capital, because it is so very important. And we cannot discuss all these other things and neglect this reality. And so at great length, he speaks about concepts of labor and capital and outlines a vision that labor, the working people of the country, it must always be protected. It must always be defended by government against the abuses of those who have great concentrations of wealth, great concentrations of power. And it was an outline for one of the most radical things he did as president, which was to sign the Homestead Act. And the Homestead Act was a free soil law. It was a redistribution of land to very poor people across the country. And it was not delinked from the Civil War. There was a view that you needed to counter the slave power, the plantation power of the South, with smallholders, with small farmers who would produce food, who would create a large and diverse group of people mm-hmm. who were not, you know, all about concentrated wealth. And so Lincoln knew exactly what he was doing. It wasn't this was not some sort of, like brain melt or something where he went off on some tangent. He saw this discussion of labor and capital as essential to...
Yeah, the defining struggle of American history after the war.
And he also saw it as essential to building the movement to defeat the South, because Lincoln understood that there was a great deal of questioning in the North among folks of, you know, why do I want to get in this fight? Some people saying, why don't we just let the South go? Other people saying, who cares what happens in the South? It wasn't all everybody in it to do this. And what Lincoln was saying is, look, you know, we do have to defeat the South. We have to then bring it back into the Union. But we then have to have a vision of, a distribution of our wealth and power that is much more equitable, that does not allow for this, you know, the power of a plantation owner or something like that.
Our guest today, John Nichols, who you've been listening to, author of the brand new book, which we're discussing, The S Word, A Short History of an American Tradition, Socialism, published by Verso. It's funny, John Nichols, I saw the review in the Washington Post, and I saw it online, and they have these comments afterwards where people can make their comments on the review. And one of them was, it was hilarious. Someone wrote and said, I haven't read this book, but I can tell you there's absolutely no reason for anyone to read it. Socialism is horrible. It's anti-American. It's terrible. And it was exactly why he wrote the book. I was like, thank you for giving – there should have been a blurb on the book.
But I was delighted by it. The Washington Post review was just a lovely review and very thoughtful. And this has been one of the most interesting things. People who do read the book, including some of my conservative friends, have come away from it very, very generous in their comments.
It's a terrific book.
Well, I think I'm not trying to say, well, I wrote a good book. What I'm saying is, when you actually come into contact with this history, I don't see it as something that ought to be threatening to anybody. What it really is a reminder that we have historically had much better debates in America. And I actually think that many of my libertarian friends will recognize that, because despite all the talk about, you know, conservatism and even libertarianism being on the march today, you know, ideas, you know, pure right-wing ideas, really ideas that are on the right and an equivalent level of ideas that are on the left, are also often denied and pushed to the sides. Mm-hmm. And historically in this country, we had a great big robust debate. One of the things that's most fascinating to me is that in 1950, when Robert Taft proposed that the Republican Party run against the Democrats in the 1950 off-year elections on a slogan of liberty against socialism, the Republican Party basically said, you know, the main leaders of the Republican Party said, screw that. You know, that's a crazy thing to say, because, you know, while we don't like Soviet communism per se, and Truman doesn't either, this notion that, you know, we're going to build all of our arguments around the evil of socialism, the evil of, say, Social Security or Medicare or what would become Medicare or a national health care program, that was considered kind of an absurd and very foolish way to go. And yet today, I write about this in the book, in 2009, the Republican National Committee passed a resolution in which they suggested the Democratic Party ought to rename itself the Democratic Socialist Party. And so in many ways, we today are at a point where we're kind of more, our discussion is more absurd and more narrow than it was during the McCarthy era.
No, I agree. It is absurd. And John Nichols, you and I could talk about this endlessly. Unfortunately, we've only got about 12 or 14, 13 minutes left, and we've barely touched this book. And one area we're going to skip over entirely now is the long discussion in the book of the heyday of socialism in America, the first few decades of the 20th century, which is worthy of an entire show, and the important work on the First Amendment, freedom of the press, that came out of that thanks to socialists. And we can't do that justice and cover anything else. So what I want to do now is go ahead to what I also considered, similar to Lincoln, one of the really most fascinating and relevant parts of the book, which is the discussion of a person you've already mentioned, A. Philip Randolph, and then Martin Luther King and their relationship, and the relationship of socialism and socialist ideas to the whole civil rights movement as it devolved. Let's start with A. Philip Randolph. Who was he? What did he do? Why should we care about him?
Well, I got to tell you, A. Philip Randolph, to my view, is probably the least known, most significant person in American history. You know, if you can be both at the same time. And part of it is that this country does not do a particularly good job of writing labor history. And frankly, it hasn't until recently, and thanks to the work of Howard Zinn and some others, hadn't done a very good job of writing the history of African Americans. Well, here you have an A. Philip Randolph, the first major African American labor leader in the country. So, you know, he gets the double whammy. But let me tell you, this guy, so incredibly fascinating, came out of the South from Jacksonville, Illinois, or Jacksonville, Florida. Yeah, Jacksonville, Illinois. There is a Jacksonville, Illinois.
I know. Which I was thinking, it's not the South.
It's funny. I just brought it up because I'd just been through it. Jacksonville, Florida. And he came north. He had grown up in deeply segregated South. He came to Harlem in that great migration of Southern blacks to Harlem. And he came as a dandy, as a kind of a hip young man, and hung out, got a group of friends.
This is in the teens.
Yeah, in the early teens. And what they were all about was, kind of radical ideas. And he very early on became a passionate socialist. In fact, he edited a publication called The Messenger, which identified itself as the most radical publication in America. He was very proud of that. And he was deeply involved in the Socialist Party. He was its candidate for state office in New York on a regular basis. And then,
he's a very young man.
He's in his 20s. And then he decided to throw himself into the labor movement and to formed what essentially became the pioneering African-American-led union in America, which is the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters.
Now, we have a whole generation of people who have no idea what a sleeping car porter is.
Well, there's a guy named Pullman who created these cars, and you could sleep in them. And every car, you get on the train. It's like a sleeper car on the train. But it was all owned by this one company, the Pullman Company. And they hired ex-slaves to be the porters, the guys who worked in each car.
Purely African American.
It was all African American. They were all male and ex-slaves generally. Although as the years went on, you had the children.
Yeah.
But the key thing was that Pullman thought that former slaves would have the proper attitude toward the wealthy white people that would be in the sleeper cars. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of an ugly thing. They were all referred to as George because Pullman's first name was George. So no matter what your real name was, every sleeping car porter was referred to as George. It was an ugly and unpleasant situation, and it was made worse by the fact that the sleeping car porters became the real men of the world of the African American community. They did travel.
It's like sailors who travel the world. Yeah.
But they became by far some of the most educated and politically engaged people. Mm-hmm. And so when they decided to form a movement, they took this socialist who was not a sleeping car porter, A. Philip Randolph, and they said, "Will you be our leader?" And he agreed to do so. It was a remarkable moment. He built this union into something huge. And the significant thing was that because they're sleeping car porters, they were everywhere in America. right? Mm-hmm. They were spread out all over the country. They used to take socialist publications and union publications and wrap them up at night after everybody was asleep on the train, and the train cars would be going through the rural South. Mm-hmm. They'd go, you know, past like a little shotgun shack, and they carried rubber bands in their pockets. They would throw the newspaper onto the front of the shack so that somebody would wake up in the morning and suddenly they'd have this something they'd never read before. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so they really spread the civil rights movement. And in fact, it was a sleeping car porter who was a critical player in the Montgomery bus boycott, the guy who actually brought King into that movement. And again and again and again, you see Randolph challenging the government of the United States to respect African Americans. He threatened Roosevelt with a march on Washington if Roosevelt didn't integrate the war industries of World War II.
And just to get to the point you make in the book, that it's almost self-evident, but it bears repeating, which is, you know, civil rights to A. Philip Randolph and later for Martin Luther King and mm-hmm. the leaders was not simply about sitting at a lunch counter. It was an economic.
Oh, yeah, it was very economic. And in fact, it's central to everything that they were all about. And so as the civil rights movement got going, Randolph realized very early that King was an incredible organizer, an incredible player. And so he formed a deep, close relationship with King. And I write a lot about this in the book because it's so essential to understanding that Randolph gave King the network nationally through the sleeping car porters and other unions to really expand out a civil rights movement, not just in the South, but in lots of other places. And they were very, very close. They worked intimately together for years. And the March on Washington was, of course, a critical moment. But what came after that was even more critical. They developed what they referred to as a freedom budget. And it was a vision.
Now we're talking 64, 65.
It was a vision of a social democratic America. And it had, you know, really shifting immense amounts of spending to health care, housing, all of the needs of society to create an equity in America, not just for African Americans, but for all people, so that anybody who's poor could have a leg up. It goes back to that Paineite vision of, you know, let's make this a just society. And what's important to understand about that time is that they aligned with a young guy, Michael Harrington, who had written The Other America and who was, in fact, advising the Johnson administration in its war on poverty.
He must have been a free market guy, right?
No, Michael Harrington was the leading young socialist in the United States at the time, and he was regularly at the White House advising on the formation of Medicare, Medicaid, things like
but
that.
But he was in the Socialist Party. I mean, again,
he was publicly identified as a
socialist. This is not something he hid in the—
And regularly writing, I might add, regularly writing op-eds for the New York Times as such. And so, again, this tells you how recently somebody being a socialist was not considered a particularly damning thing or a particularly bad thing. And so the fascinating thing, though, is that this freedom budget campaign is such an amazing struggle because they debuted it at the White House with Lyndon Johnson and other folks there. They didn't get everything they wanted. There's simply no question of that. But these ideas were not pushed to the sidelines. They were not rejected. And
we had the war on poverty.
Exactly. And
Sergeant Shriver, the whole works.
And Harrington, who was so very, very close to Randolph and to King, writes about this a great deal. But you know, it's no secret. You know, Eric Dyson and others have written about this. King was quite blunt in the mid-60s, after the civil rights movement began to get real traction, of saying, you know, look, we have to look at ways to make this a just society, not just on paper, but in reality, economically. And so it was King himself who talked about democratic socialism and who said as much in many of his speeches and public addresses. And so the idea that, you know, we've sanitized Martin Luther King Jr. and said, you know, wow, he's just this really good guy who fought against discrimination. And he was. But he was also concerned about economic justice, not just racial justice.
Well, as people in Wisconsin were noting numerous times over the last 3 months, the last event he attended
was a AFSCME strike in Memphis, Tennessee, by sanitation workers who were arguing for collective bargaining and basic respect on the job. It was a union struggle. And indeed, AFSCME at that time was led by a Democratic Socialist, and in fact had been led, its first two presidents were very strong Democratic Socialists, and King was very, very close to them, Jerry Wirth and then Arnold Zander before him. And again, this is history. This is American history.
You know,
it's a central part of our history.
Put an exclamation point on your discussion of Martin Luther King, just in case there's anyone who thinks that it's not clear. I mean, when you read this book, or you just read King's own work for the last 3 or 4 years of his life, mm-hmm. and you say, how do you describe his worldview? It's pretty much impossible to avoid saying socialist, isn't it?
I mean, well, I want to be
democratic, social democrat.
He said as much in some speeches.
I mean, you talk about radically changing the economy and using mm-hmm. that term. I mean, that's not the term of someone who likes things the way they are.
No, and I want to say that one of the most useful figures in this is Coretta Scott King, his wife. And in her books about King, it's just fascinating stuff. Again, underread and underregarded. Yeah, she wrote about, King courted her with discussions of Karl Marx. They would write letters back and forth about Marxism. King had problems with Marx, but he was a very nuanced reader of Marx mm-hmm. and a critic at times, but also if you want to look at King's reference points, he again and again went back to the Christian socialists of the 1890s and early years of the 20th century. This was a very strong movement, particularly in New England, but mm-hmm. in other parts of the country. And so he was influenced by a host of socialist ideas, and in fact had many socialists on his staff and working with him. And respected them. That doesn't mean, again, I think this is the important thing to understand. Whether King was a socialist or not, and whether Lyndon Johnson, where you put him on the ideological spectrum, or Dwight Eisenhower, the important thing to understand is that until very recently in this country, if you were in a position of influencing the debate or maybe even shaping the debate as a president, you invited socialists and social democrats into your circle. You read their books. You thought about their ideas. You rejected some. But you also took some, because that was the fullness of a discourse. And in America today, my biggest concern is that we've narrowed the discourse so much that we're not taking particularly good ideas from the right or the left. We tend to be taking a mushy center of ideas, pretty much shaped by corporate spin. And until not that long ago in this country, that would have been considered not just absurd, but really antithetical.
The way you describe it, it seems like the range of debate is basically conforming to the money that defines the debate, both in media and in elections.
Yeah, it is. And it's devastating. I think that has been profoundly harmful to this country in so many ways. And, one of the sections of the book I talk about, that it seems, I don't think Barack Obama is a socialist. He says he isn't. The socialists say he isn't. But the best proof of it is that even when there are socialist or social democratic ideas that make sense, like a single-payer healthcare system as opposed to the mess that came out of that debate last year, like using the government to clean up the disaster in the Gulf, not letting the company that made the mess be in charge of it, like really regulating the banks and Wall Street after they pretty much crashed the economy, he rejects those ideas. And it's not a condemnation of Obama so much as a suggestion that when a guy who is portrayed as the great, kind of liberal president of the moment rejects ideas that pretty much the rest of the world would see as mainstream ideas, we've warped our debate. Mm-hmm. We've made such a narrow debate that it is dysfunctional. And until we get comfortable with our history, a lot more comfortable with our history, I don't think we can have a healthy contemporary debate.
Well, I think your book's going to go a long way towards opening people's eyes to that history. Well, we only got a minute or two left. And John Nichols, one thing that you allude to in the book and we've talked about is that despite the fact that in official circles, socialism is nowhere to be found, it's the S word, as you put it, and it's just something to be avoided. What's astonishing is in a series of public opinion polls, mm-hmm. the degree to which socialism still has, or increasingly has, a positive impression in the minds of a significant number of Americans. I mean, literally tens of millions of Americans respond to the term socialism favorably, mm-hmm. and young Americans as favorably to socialism as they do to capitalism.
Absolutely. It's simply fascinating. And in certain racial groups, among women more than men, you have the polling is some of the most powerful stuff around. And what I think has happened is, I don't think everybody knows every detail of socialism or social democratic ideas.
But they know capitalism.
Well, that's it. I think in a time when the so-called free market economies doesn't seem to be delivering very well, people look for alternatives. And I also think something else fascinating has happened. I think the demonization of socialism by a Glenn Beck or a Sean Hannity or a Sarah Palin mm-hmm. actually causes a lot of people to go, okay, those folks don't like it. There must be something to it then, because I don't agree with them. I don't think their worldview works. And so in a way, I see many of the conservative critics of socialism and social democratic ideas as kind of raising them up mm-hmm. and putting them in the debate. And this is interesting because the same thing happened to some extent during the McCarthy era. And as you look at it, where we kind of ricocheted out of the McCarthy era was a period in which a lot of more radical ideas were far more accepted in society because you had an awful lot of young people who had come up not buying into McCarthy and not buying into the Red Scare. And so as they came of age, they looked for alternative ideas. And perhaps Sarah Palin may be doing more of a service to socialism than anybody else.
Maybe she's a Manchurian candidate. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, her husband was a member of a union.
Ooh, that's pretty scary stuff.
Yeah, and look, and frankly, there's no more socialist state than Alaska because they love those stipends from the government.
Government largesse, absolutely.
But I do think this is an important thing to understand, that as we look at the debate today, a lot of people are seeing through the spin and saying, you know, look, I want to think about this. And
John
thinking
Nichols,
is good.
On that note, I want to thank you for joining us today on Media Matters. The book, again, The S Word, A Short History of an American Tradition Socialism by John Nichols, published by Verso. You'll be delighted when you read it. Thank you very much. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. Be back 1 week from today. Until then, everyone, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
The forecast for East Central Illinois. Today, chance of showers with a high near 63. Tonight, occasional showers and thunderstorms could produce heavy rain with a low around 50. Monday, occasional showers and thunderstorms with a high near 64. Monday night, showers and thunderstorms with a low around 56. Tuesday, chance of showers with a high near 65. Tuesday night, showers and thunderstorms with a low around 50. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana.